You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 189, by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Conscious Society, Anthroposophy and the Social Question. 8 lectures given in Dornach between the 15th of February and the 16th of March, 1919, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 1 given in Dornach on the 15th of February, 1919. The lectures I have given here recently included a number concerning the social question that has come to be of such burning importance today. Unless we sleepwalk through events with which our own life is inextricably entangled, we will not fail to notice that this social question, as it has come to be called, really is of urgent and burning concern. You will be able to see from these lectures, some of which, in essence at least, I have also given as public talks in various places in Switzerland, that this social question has assumed a form very critical to the existential needs of modern humanity and relates to all recent developments in human society. In our own circles, too, within the anthroposophic movement, a need has arisen to consider the destiny of humanity, as this relates specifically also to the social question, and to form judgments drawn from our outlook that could be turned into reality in the way in which we are capable of doing this. For a long time now, some of our members have made efforts to place their strength in the service of these very difficult times in which we now live. In the process, various ideas and objectives have been pursued. It is, of course, true to say, my dear friends, that each person can only intervene in events in which he is destined to participate by his destiny, his karma, let us say by his place within humanity. The diverse aspirations that have arisen within our movement have led to the following. The three gentlemen who set themselves the task of working in Stuttgart in a way that addresses the existential need of our time, these three gentlemen whom you know well, Herr Molt, Dr. Buss, Herr Kuhn, came to see me at the beginning of February. We formulated the aim, as far as possible and useful, to realize in practice what we can draw from our outlook and worldview. Now, my dear friends, when we are concerned not with reflections, but with realities, it can only ever be a question of what is fitting and appropriate at a very particular time, what can be initiated in a particular respect and context. Not much will be gained usually by raging like a bull in a china shop. We have to make a tentative beginning in some way. Given existing realities and precedents, it seemed to us appropriate, firstly, to do something that can at present seem the right course of action for the sorely burdened German people. If we look at current events, the first thing that strikes us, and I have often described this, is the chasm existing between different social classes. On the one hand, what we can call the ruling classes as they have been up to now, and on the other the proletariat, the working classes who have been at the forefront of real demands relating to the social question. But a careful scrutiny will show that this proletariat appears in two forms, the proletariat as such, and then its leaders. I have often spoken here of the fact that all the ideas, feelings, aspirations, and impulses which these proletarian leaders have in their heads, which gain sway over the working classes, are basically the legacy of the bourgeois thinking of recent centuries. We discussed these things from all kinds of angles and have tried to consolidate our understanding of them. But at the end of the day, we came back to the fact that a deep chasm does indeed exist between these social classes. In the last few days, all of us will have been made aware once again of the depth of this divide. On the one hand, Paris, where, based on their particular outlook, the ruling classes took in hand the fate of modern humanity, and on the other, Bern, with an assembly testifying to the chasm, dividing its participants from those others. If you carefully followed what is emerging from Paris, as well as efforts being made at the Socialist Congress in Bern, you will have to acknowledge that the ideas and intentions issuing either from Paris or Bern are not the important thing. The thing that is really incisive for humanity's evolution in the long term is the fact that two radically divergent social languages are being spoken in these two places. If we are truly honest, we have to acknowledge this, that there are two completely different languages being spoken here, and no possibility of mutual understanding between them. Reader's aside footnote concerning Paris. After the Compiègne Armistice between the Central and Western powers, no real conference took place. The Paris Peace Conference that began in Versailles on the 18th of January 1919 was only a gathering of delegates from the 27 Entente states for the purpose of deciding upon conditions to be imposed on the Central Axis powers. End of footnote, and back to the lecture. This phenomenon is so fundamentally important that anyone who properly reflects upon it must acknowledge what I have often said here, that we need to seek much deeper foundations than those usually sought if we are to understand what is at work here, and if we are to work toward possible solutions. As I said the day before yesterday in the public lecture in Basel, the social question, the social movement, is of such pressing importance for a large swath of civilization today, requires such urgent response, appears so incisive in historical terms, that it is hard to conceive of any previous time in humanity's history where things were as pressing. We need, therefore, to draw on deeper foundations. And as I have so often suggested, we only find these deeper foundations in an outlook on reality which is the point of departure, also for studying social aspects of life, of our spiritual scientific movement, of anthroposophically oriented spiritual science. At our New Year gathering, I believe I pointed to something important, that one can certainly be very pessimistic about humanity, not only in some vaguer emotional way, but based on a real appraisal of society. I read to you an essay by a man who was well qualified to make such an appraisal. And then I said that such a sober and pessimistic outlook, as he was expressing, is nevertheless only possible if we are unaware of the help we can get by turning to the Spirit. This awareness should become ever more widespread, that destructive forces which will take dire effect in the forthcoming decades can only be seen as inevitable if we refuse to turn to a view of reality that emerges from spiritual science. Of course, I do not mean by this the dogmas of this or that spiritual movement. I mean, in general, the invoking of spiritual forces that at this important turning point of humanity's evolution are the only available wholesome and healing powers. Thus we can say that one aspect of this anthroposophically oriented spiritual science will at the same time, in the most eminent sense, provide a cure for the ills of our era, since it does not issue from anything arbitrary, but from true observation of the forces currently at work in the world. It really is not randomly conceived. It really is not a program devised by one person or a group of people, but has emerged from observation of what the spiritual guidance of the cosmos itself dictates as a necessary influx into humanity's current development. This alone allows us to speak as we do of anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, for otherwise it would be arrogance to do so. But what originates, in fact, from honest humility need not fear the foolish objections it meets with as it seeks expression from those who label it arrogance. From Paris, we can say, issues all that is born on the grandiose wings of an outlook that has clearly led to absurdity over the past 4.5 years. From Bern has issued something that a number of people regard as a remedy, but which does not draw on a deep enough source. From Paris there issues something that alarms almost all of humankind. From Bern came something a great number of people pinned their hopes on. These two things still speak a completely different language, and there is no communication across the chasm dividing them. This communication will only become possible when the soul seeks to appeal inwardly to spiritual science. It was this that gave rise to the thought of reaching out to one part of humanity at least, seeking its understanding. For understanding is what is required. I have repeatedly stressed that we will make no headway in the chaos in society without first gaining understanding from a sufficiently large number of people in the civilized world, and doing so before instincts start to run rampant. This is also what underlay the spirit of my lectures in Zurich, Bern, and Basel. What I have continually discussed with various people recently is how we can appeal to people's understanding, and whether it is even possible at all to count on some degree of understanding before a full-scale debacle breaks out. Now, this latter question is not in fact one that we can ask if we are in tune with reality, for then we do not establish hypotheses about what may or may not be possible, but instead we take the measures we consider necessary. When we embark on a path, we have to take the first step. And we should not think, if this first step does not immediately appear to be identical with the desired goal, that it should therefore be discounted. After all, the first step on a long journey can only ever cover a very small part of it. All that matters in aiming for a particular goal is that we do not start by heading in the opposite direction, or deviate to left or right. And secondly, that we maintain the will to persist in our intent, once we have embarked on it, and do not allow ourselves to be pushed to left and right by all the obstacles we might encounter. Besides this, if we wish to root ourselves in reality, we have to relate to actual contemporary conditions, to what exists, and not build castles in the air. Our ideas have to relate to something already manifest, already present as a real tendency. It can sometimes actually seem as if our first step were a very hapless one, and it may only become clear that it is not after we have gone a little further down the road. When these three gentlemen, Molt, Bos, and Kuhn, came to discuss these things with me, firstly we had to ask, since after all a spiritual impulse was necessarily involved, and an appeal to people's insight, what in our experience meets with a response from human thinking? You will recall the title Appeal to the Civilized World, the supposedly civilized world, made once by, 99 professors, people well known in Germany. If we judge according to reality rather than simply out of emotion, we are likely to consider this appeal to have been extremely inept. Well, Of course, most of them were professors. Nevertheless, it made an impression. It found its way into people's minds in a very unfortunate manner. And the effects still echo on today. In some respects, it was a reality, one that contributed more to the downfall of the German people than many other things. It created waves. And so this thought occurred. How would it be now, at a time when things are so desperate, to counter this sum of ideas that were issued back then, were unleashed on humanity, ideas that were blatantly outmoded, by doing something to nurture communication and understanding? An appeal to humanity drawn now from real existing conditions. Initially, as seems self-evident, this appeal would be directed to the German people, whose destiny it has been to see its supposed task swept away along with its whole legislature. One could initially appeal to this German nation, pointing out what realities themselves make plain, not mere words, judgments, and thoughts, but facts and realities. While such an appeal might be addressed in vain to a great part of humanity, because the old frameworks still survive, it is conceivable that the German people would hear it, since their old foundations have simply been pulled from under their feet. They might recognize that the old certainties no longer sustain them, but that a new basis must be found for their task in the world. That is how people are, after all. As long as the old sustains them a little, even if they change their outward garb, they cling to old customs and ignore everything that is telling them they can't actually go on clinging to it any longer. You have scarcely any idea what a role comfort plays in the inner life of humankind. Well, with these thoughts in mind, my dear friends, I wrote a kind of manifesto, which I think might be heard by souls who, in respect of the question of our culture, are open to communication founded on a healthy ground of reality. I think it might be understood initially by insightful people in the German nation, to whom it is specifically directed. But it also seems to me that it should be read by enemies of the German people, as something that can be seen at present as appropriate for this German nation to consider and realize. In view of the fact that the earlier appeal I mentioned was signed by 99 people, I thought it might be good if once again we could find another 99 within the boundaries of German Germany, of former Austria, and that perhaps these 99 might be joined by a small number of others in neutral countries, particularly in Switzerland, who are open to understanding present existential needs. If all this were possible, it seemed to me, we might achieve something positive, to redress the previous negative influence of those other 99 figures. I hope you will understand me aright. The appeal is, first and foremost, addressed to the German nation. But what is aired in this way within the German nation should also be heard throughout the civilized world. I will now read the appeal. The ideas it contains will be familiar to you, my dear friends, since we have often discussed them. Of course, they can be only briefly expounded in this succinct form. The aim here is not to instruct anyone, but to say something that can point people's attention to the existence of a way forward, and to the right way of embarking on it. Naturally, some may object to the brevity of this appeal, yet it is not a manual, but merely a pointer to the fact that there are sources of help within humanity. Here it is, to the German people and the civilized world. The German people believed that the edifice of their empire, constructed half a century ago, was assured forever. It seemed to them in August 1914, at the outset of the catastrophic war, that this edifice would prove invincible, Today they gaze upon its ruins. Such experience, given that it has shown half a century's beliefs, and especially the prevailing outlook of the war years, to be a tragic error, must be followed by self-reflection. What were the causes of this fateful error? This question must inevitably lead to long and deep self-examination by the German people. Their capacity to survive and develop will depend on whether they can find the strength for such self-examination. Their future depends on whether they can truly take this question to heart. How did I succumb to this error of mine? If they can ask this question of themselves today, it will dawn on them that half a century ago they founded an empire and yet omitted to assign it a task that sprang from the intrinsic nature of the German culture, of the German people. An empire was founded, and in its early period, efforts were made to organize its living inner potential in accordance with the needs arising from year to year, from both old traditions and new demands. Later this changed, so that instead an outward sway and power rooted in material forces was consolidated and enlarged, connected with measures relating to the social demands emerging in the new era. While these measures did take some account of much that arose as current necessity, they lacked the larger vision that should have arisen from insight into the developmental powers toward which modern humanity must turn. Thus the empire was embedded in a world context without having an essential goal that justified its existence. And this became sadly apparent as the catastrophic war unfolded. Before the outbreak of the war, non-German countries of the world could have seen nothing in the conduct of this empire that might have suggested that those governing it were in any way fulfilling a world historical mission, one that ought not to be brushed aside. Its failure to find such a mission inevitably led to the view amongst other nations that for people with real insight is the deeper cause of the German collapse. For the German people, an immeasurable amount now depends on their unprejudiced assessment of the situation. Misfortune should lead to insights that people refused to contemplate in the previous 50 years. In the place of a small-minded appraisal of the needs arising as we move into the immediate future, we need a broad survey of the developmental powers at work in modern humanity, a strength of mind to try to perceive them and to dedicate ourselves to them with courageous will. We must overcome the petty view that all who focus on these developmental powers are useless and impractical idealists. The time is over for the pride and arrogance of those who think they are pragmatists, and yet whose narrow-mindedness, masquerading as practicality, has led to this misfortune. It is high time to recognize what those decried as idealists, who are in fact the truly practical ones, have to say about the developmental needs of the modern era. For a long time now, the pragmatists of all persuasions have seen quite new needs arising for humanity, but they sought to accommodate them within the framework of old traditional habits of thinking and institutions. Modern economic life has led to these needs and demands, and it seemed impossible to satisfy them by means of private initiatives. In specific fields, one class of people thought it imperative to lead private labor over into social labor. And this was brought about in the areas that the social class deemed profitable to it. It became the goal of a different social class to radically transform all individual labor into social productivity. Contemplating the development of modern economic life, this latter class had no interest in preserving the old private goals. all efforts that have so far emerged to meet the needs of modern humanity share one thing in common. They seek socialization of the private sector and count here on communal bodies, the state, local government, taking this over. Yet these bodies originate from conditions that have no connection with the new needs and demands. Alternatively, people count on newer types of association, such as collectives or cooperatives, that were not directly founded to meet these new demands, but which have been created in the image of the old forms, through traditional modes of thinking. The truth is that no communal institution created in line with these old modes of thinking can be a proper vehicle for what is now necessary. The times urge us to discern a social structure for humanity that takes account of factors very different from those usually considered. Hitherto, social communities have largely arisen through humankind's social instincts. It is the mission of our era to bring full consciousness to bear, now, on the powers at work in society. The structure of the social organism is like the natural organism of the human being. And just as our heads and not our lungs are responsible for thinking, the social organism must be articulated in different systems, none of which can be taken over by another, each preserving its autonomy, while at the same time interacting and collaborating with the others. Economic life can only thrive if it develops as an independent element of the social organism in line with its own forces and laws, rather than being brought into disarray by the invasion of a different sector of the social organism, that of politics. This political element should instead exist in full autonomy alongside the economic realm, just as in the natural organism the respiratory and head systems exist alongside each other. These would not function in wholesome harmony if governed by identical laws. And likewise, politics and economics must each be administered by their own laws and systems of management, albeit in living interaction with each other. This is because the political system will inevitably destroy the economy if it seeks to take it over, while the economic system loses its life forces when it seeks to become political. Then, a third element must join these two sectors of the social organism, once again in full independence, and formed in accordance with its own living potentiality, that of spiritual or cultural productivity. This third realm at the same time encompasses the spiritual portion of the two other spheres, supplying this to them out of its own intrinsic laws and manner of administration. Once again, this third sphere cannot be controlled or influenced except as it happens in the mutually influencing parts of a natural organism. What has been said here of the requirements of the social organism can already be fully substantiated and developed in all details. In these comments, we have only established the general principles involved for all who wish to pursue these vital matters further. The German Empire was founded at a time when these imperatives started to arise for modern humanity. Its government failed to understand how to shape its task in accordance with these imperatives. If it had done so, this would not only have given the empire the right inner constitution, but would also have lent justification to its outward policies. And through these, the German people could have lived harmoniously with other nations. Now disaster can help us gain insight. We need to develop the will for a potential social organism. The other countries of the world ought not to find a void where Germany once was. Instead, three systems, with three autonomous delegations, cultural, spiritual, political and economic, should negotiate with those who vanquished the one Germany, a nation which, through disarray and confusion of the three systems, became an impossible social structure. One can just imagine the, in quotes, pragmatists objecting vociferously to the complexity of what has been said here, and finding it hard even to contemplate the collaborative interplay of three entities, because they have no desire to acknowledge life's actual demands, instead trying to shape everything in line with the comfortable dictates of their own thinking. They will have to recognize that there are only two alternatives, either to submit our thinking to the demands of reality, or to learn nothing from misfortune, and thus infinitely multiply the dire scope of what has already occurred. All right, that's the end of Steiner's appeal to the German people, and now we're back to the lecture. Steiner again. The three gentlemen I mentioned have now set off for Germany with this appeal, and while I have been giving my lectures here in Zurich, Basel, and Bern, they have been trying to realize what we envisaged, to find near enough 100 signatories. Herr Stein took on this task for Austria, while other people have been undertaking similar efforts here in Switzerland. Well, there hasn't been much time yet, but we can be very pleased at the response so far to this first step. We have launched an appeal supported in the same way as that hapless earlier one. At my latest lectures in Zurich, held quite intentionally in Zurich, since Switzerland is currently the fulcrum of all international events, my aim was to show that there are people, here and there, with dawning understanding of these things. And naturally, therefore, I wanted to hear the outcome before I gave the last Zurich lecture. It was very pleasing to learn that we had obtained 100 signatures so far, excluding Switzerland and Vienna. I was informed of this on the 11th already. This news reached me from Germany, where our friends had left no stone unturned to achieve it. On the same day, the 11th, at midday, I received a telegram from Vienna saying they had obtained 73 signatures and would assuredly get more the following day, which indeed turned out to be so. 93 by the next day. Herr Stein sent me this news. And then a further number of signatures were added retrospectively. The results so far, therefore, have been very satisfying, and it would be welcome, now we have got this far, if a number of people, including well-known figures, people whose view is respected, since this is important in such a campaign, would publish such an appeal wherever this can be done, so that it is seen, read, and comes to the attention of those for whom it is intended. Actually, it concerns everyone in the world today. It is true to say that something lives in the depths of human souls that draws them toward understanding of such concerns. In the course of these lectures, I have said that the idea now manifesting in this form is not a new one of mine. Back at a decisive turning point in this catastrophic war, I was trying to help realize this necessary impulse in the places where I could. I described to you how this came about. Back then I was telling those to whom these things needed to be addressed that this is not a program, not an ideal, but rather something observed and observable in terms of developmental forces in modern humanity. Something seeking definite realization in the next 10, 20, or 30 years. It cannot be a matter of whether or not it comes to pass, but only how it does so. And I said to quite a few key figures back then that they had the choice either to pursue a rational course in order to realize something like this, or to witness social cataclysms and revolutions. It did not take long for people to recognize that this was no false prophecy. but comfort-loving folk today find it hard to move on from a certain understanding to developing the courage necessary to make such things reality, insofar as their position allows. Here in Switzerland, a few signatories have been found too, but there is a concern here, given that the first part of the appeal speaks of the need for the German people to examine themselves and reflect on the error in which they were entangled, that it might not be the place of the Swiss to tell the Germans what to do. But in my view, dear friends, this reservation is no longer appropriate. As old mummified ideas, such concerns may have had some significance prior to 1914, but they no longer do so today. Nowadays there is no place anymore for the pettiness reflected in this kind of national reserve. The last disastrous 4.5 years have surely taught us this. It is high time to think differently, forgive me, even in Switzerland, from the way people thought just 4.5 years ago. Here, too, people should have learned something if they have observed the last 4.5 years with any acuity. This brief period can appear to us like centuries. And it is almost beyond belief when the old national prejudices and other such preconceptions, old mummified ways of thinking, which really should have ended in 1914, are thought to be in the right foundation for a new world order, a new map of Europe. This European house of cards will quickly collapse when shaken apart by the other forces. The social realities which alone hold sway today, and are the sole determining factors in what is called politics. Everything else just masks this reality. And the Europeans will be sorely mistaken if they try to judge things and object to things in terms of the old habitual modes of mummified thinking. Of course, it can be said, and I could easily give you a compendious account of all the refutations, that this appeal is a proposal for all countries to adopt, and could only come about if they all made a start on it. No, my dear friends, a single state can make a beginning. The proposals are perfectly well suited to that, and if one country does so, it has done something for the benefit of all mankind. It was the German people's misfortune that their empire was founded in a phase of modern history, at a time when it had become necessary to inform it with this mission. Because this mission was not embraced, other nations could not understand what on earth it was doing, what its raison d'être was. If it had adopted and pursued this mission, all events would have taken a different course. Its existential justification would then have been apparent and palpable. Nowadays, people's thinking and judgments are trapped in mummified ideas. You see, there are a great number of people in Europe who cannot free themselves from their old mummified ideas about Europe. And yet, at the same time, their fear leads them to regard the world grandee, Wilson, as some kind of, well, I'm not sure how to put it, as a redeemer. But people ought to refrain from their views of Wilson before ascertaining how he became so influential in his country. He did so out of his healthy American instinct, precisely by combating all the other parties with a politics diametrically opposed to what a great part of Europe now wishes to slide into. A great portion of Europe wants to sail into a community, a social community politics, in which the freedom of the individual, each person's distinct powers, will go under. Wilson owes his election and his influence solely to the fact that as an American Democrat, he helped unleash the individual forces embedded in the economy. Let us, hypothetically, assume that Europe were to achieve the ideals of Bolshevism, the ideals of Bernese social democracy. I mean the social democracy of the Socialist Congress that took place in Bern. If we assume this were realized, that people achieved these dreams of theirs, then Europe would become a configuration from which, despite all national prejudices, all powers of freedom would necessarily drain away to free America, where Wilson himself came to power through precisely the opposite. Terrible competition would develop between Europe and America, and this would inevitably lead to Europe's impoverishment and the enrichment of America, not because of injustice, but due to the idiocy of socialist politics in Europe. This is what would happen if in Europe we do not conceive and realize social forces in a way that corresponds to the healthy social organism, which is precisely the task of European humanity. This appeal is not something that has simply been conceptually elaborated, but it points, rather, to powers everywhere at work in reality, powers that must be realized, and without whose realization, not only the fate of Germany and Austria, but of all Europe too, must truly succumb to impoverishment, misery, and unspirituality. We live at a grave time, in which small-mindedness will not suffice. Something lives in people themselves too, which draws them to what is expressed in this appeal. That is an observable fact. And because this is so, because we may harbor hope that we can reach people's hearts and souls, an attempt has now been made to reshape what we tried to do during the war, in the way appropriate then, and adapt it for current conditions. I hope, though, that no one will think that these proposals are intended as absolute. In January 1918, I spoke of them to a gentleman who later became a key figure in the terms in which they were couched at the time. But I told him that they could, of course, always assume different forms in accordance with changing conditions. This is because they are not theoretical, not a program or ideal, but are conceived and drawn from reality. And I said, therefore, that because of this I was not pursuing a course such as that of many utopians. Utopian programs are based on the idea that they must be realized as formulated, and that things will go badly otherwise. But this is not my aim in the slightest. It may be that such a proposal makes an impression on people, and that because it is practically conceived, they begin to realize it in practice. In any and every field of life today, one can say very clearly already how a beginning can be made with practical implementation. But I could also imagine that nothing, not a single stone, might remain of what I have said here, and also in my lectures in Zurich, Bern, and Basel, that everything might assume a different configuration. If your thinking corresponds to reality, it does not matter that your formula, your principles, are realized, but that somewhere in reality they are grasped, taken hold of. What emerges from this will become apparent, and that is the important thing. Everything might develop in a different way. I want to make clear that this is absolutely possible. But certainly what will emerge will be appropriate to actual circumstances. Rather than an abstract ideal, some program, these proposals encompass forces of reality, as far removed as possible from all fantasy, and equally all dry theory. That is why I was so astonished when someone widely spoken of, whom one of these three gentlemen assumed would also be a signatory of this appeal, sent me a message expressing his surprise that an appeal written by me did not appeal more to the spirit of humanity, did not state that humanity could only find its salvation by finding a way back to the spirit. You see, people want you to keep repeating and reiterating the word spirit. But this is not the important thing. What is important is that the spirit manifests, that it shows itself able to really shape realities. The greatest harm is done by those who continually speak of spirit without seeking to pinpoint its reality. They are talking ideologically, not spiritually. And we should be thankful, my dear friends, that from within our society have emerged people with real understanding and willing to actually act on it, of what is intended here. And this elicits a response. After my last lecture in Zurich, when I referred to this appeal arising as an outcome of our deliberations, our friend Dr. Buss issued his own appeal to the gathering, calling for a number of volunteers willing to undertake practical action in this matter. The result was extremely pleasing. Naturally, some made objections, and I can well understand them. But the nature of such objections shows that people today are not rooted in reality, but are fervent dreamers. Actually, those regarded as the greatest pragmatists are fantasists of this kind. That is why I said in a lecture in Zurich that General Ludendorff himself is a fine example and embodiment of a modern fantasist, a person who acted strategically, for better or worse, and in my opinion, worse, but in relation to everything else, was far removed from a grasp of life and reality. Exerting great influence, more is the pity, he was far removed from reality and had no inkling of the real conditions within which he should have acted, an abstract idealist in the same way as any socialist utopian. It is high time that people took a long, hard look at this highly dubious term, pragmatic, which has caused endless mischief amongst humanity. This pragmatism is really nothing other than fantasy brutally implemented in reality, an unreal mode of thinking. And it is high time this were abandoned. That's the important thing, my dear friends. What is needed instead, what must come, is what springs from the spirit of the anthroposophically oriented movement, as does this appeal, which has emerged from the heart of our movement, and which I wanted to tell you about this evening as a part of our series of lectures. The end of Lecture 1.